Welcome to Attached, a platform for adding breadth and depth to everyday living. I'm Yaakov Danishevsky, and this is the conversation series focused on my book. In each episode, I invite a special guest to discuss the topic of a particular chapter and how it relates to our lives. Welcome to another Conversations episode. Today, I am joined and very, very happy and excited to be joined by Dr. Paul Mendes-Flohr, who is a very well-known and noted and accomplished scholar. I'm not going to spend too much time on introduction, but if anybody wants to Google his name, you will very quickly see quite an array of publications and accomplishments. And we're discussing today chapter 5 of the book, which is called Spiritual Humanism. And I'm going to give a very quick recap of that chapter and then turn it over to Dr. Mendes-Flohr to hear his thoughts on this topic and what direction our conversation takes us in. So the quick summary of this chapter is that what we're trying to do in this chapter is figure out how to navigate the tension between trying to be someone who is deeply spiritual and connected to a sense of something that goes beyond this physical world, and at the same time, to be somebody who's living in this world and seeing other people as people and not just objects to access some higher spirituality, and to somehow live in with that duality and to navigate that tension, which I don't think is the easiest thing in the world to do. I think that we can sometimes fall into one side of that equation or the other. And Dr. Mendes-Flohr and I actually met years ago, very, very briefly, and beyond the scholarship, what I know is that the professor is someone who kind of embodies a lot of the spiritual humanism, at least that I think of in this chapter. And so I'd really be curious to hear your thoughts on how you think about and engage this question.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Yaakov. As I indicated to Yaakov, we met many years ago, and what I remember most is his smile, which is, if I may say, it's a poetic smile. His eyes evoke poetry, as well as his prose. It's the evocation of spirit, of the whole book I had the joy of reading, but of the chapter 5 of Spiritual Humanism is clearly a poetic evocation of a certain sensibility, which I believe, and I share this with Yaakov, is central to Judaism. As Yaakov seeks to elaborate. The Hasidim have a concept borrowed from the Kabbalah, but understood somewhat differently. In Hebrew, we call it Avodah B'Gashmiut, serving God in the quotidian world, the world of everywhere, every day, which includes, of course, first and foremost, our fellow human beings. Yaakov didn't mention it, but only indirectly, but of course it... he points to Buber's great distinction between I-vow and I-it relations. I-it relations are when something is an object. I don't know if it's, is this recorded photographs or... I'm holding a piece of paper. I'm holding a pen. And these are objects which are cast in the world of it. Of course, we need the world of it in order to navigate the world. Obviously not to use this as a pretzel or to say this is a good challah bread, it's a piece of paper. but on the other hand, we often treat our fellow human beings in very subtle, nuanced ways as objects in terms of status, in terms of religion, in terms of age, etc. And that blocks, of course, the relationship to the other human being as a fellow traveler, on, if you wish to put it this way, on the road from birth to our what we say in Hebrew, the Olam Haba. There's a midrash. I'm certain Yaakov is familiar with it, regarding when Genesis, God said the world to create is good, and then it said very tov ma'od, very good, and the midrash says paradoxically, if you wish, or that it's reference to death. Death is part of our earthly journey. And we obviously have to acknowledge our finitude. Surprisingly, as a blessing, a blessing of all aspects of our life. I was very touched by a footnote in chapter 5, the very last footnote, where you reference a rabbi who talks about the plethora of brachot that we are supposed to give. You see a rainbow. I myself have recently reached the venerable age of, somewhat frightening, but it's the venerable age of 82, which of course marks the ninth decade of my terrestrial journey. And one particular prayer is crucial to me at this point. Before you get out of bed, you're supposed to, I touch myself to see I'm still here, and then just say, Modani. Something very simple. Mode ani lefanecha, melech chai v'kayam, she'echzir bi, she'echzir nishmati bi b'chemla. Thank God, the living king of the universe has restored my soul to me in love. The Hebrew word chemla is perhaps captures much of what Yaakov wanted to us to be attuned to. We have two words that's translated by the lexicographers, those who write dictionaries, as compassion. Rachmaut, Rachmanut, or Rachmonis would say in the Mamaloshin, as most of us are familiar with. The Chemla means loving compassion. And you'll find references in to that physically in the book of Isaiah, distinction between Rachmaut and Chemla. Loving compassion. And that's perhaps the way we should relate to one another. If you allow me to chat a bit more, I recently gave some lectures in Denmark, of all places, on the topic of hospitality. And it's meant in the political context, that Europe's being flooded, as they put it, flooded is a terrible word, but that's what they use by migrants, people largely from Asia and Africa seeking refuge in Europe. And they don't know how to handle it. They feel it with the customs that these individuals bring, their skin color, etc., are a threat to the homogeneity of their respective communities. So I spoke about the hospitality of the heart, which I understand is a way of expressing chemla, compassionate love of the other. And that compassion and love of the other, as Yaakov notes, is the way we meet God. For Buber, for all our relationships of what he calls I vow, when you treat the other person not as an object, and also the world about us, the world of nature, the books that we read are obviously brought forth by our fellow human beings, require a certain hospitality, of what I call hospitality of the heart. But it's a way of meeting God. Buber refers to all these relationships as a way of encountering God. And as the footnote I referred to before, it's somewhere in your heart to give a bracha, that thanking God. We all know the prayer for over bread, the usual prayers over wine, etc. But every aspect of life, as I understand it, as I hope I feel it, is a bracha. When my children visit me, my grandchildren visit, in my heart, I give a little bracha, because as the midrash that Yaakov brings to in the chapter of Abraham about to bring God into his tent and sees strangers, and he leaves God behind and reaches out to the strangers. And then the midrash says, this is preeminent, but also understand the strangers as angels of God, emissaries of the divine. And in some sense, if I'm just capture, I think, Yaakov's poetic voice and my clumsy rhetoric, is we're all angels. not necessarily in our behavior, but we should be view one another as all of us. Young and old, decrepit, learned. Unfortunately, in the academy, we have a sense that people who have PhDs and professorial titles and are somehow uniquely gifted people, or angelic people. No, we're all the postmen, the helpless and homeless individuals are all divine emissaries, and we should read them as such. So that's my brief reflections on your
thank you so much. Yeah, there's so much I want to ask about. Can I ask you to elaborate a little bit more on, you know, I've had the fortune of reading some of Buber's works in terms of I Vow, a little bit. So I'm familiar a little bit with the concept you're talking about. But let's say for somebody who's not, can you try and elaborate on what it means to relate to somebody else in an I-it way as an object, and what it would mean for us to try and move towards the I-Thou relationship?
Right. Indeed. I think the I-it is understandable. We do categorize individuals by age, by religious background, status, cultural and political status. And that's basically treating them as categories, rather than really responding to who they are. And Buber uses a very interesting term, which has biblical echoes, and I'll try to elaborate that. Presence. Presence can be understood in a grammatical term or even a temporal term. Next moment, and perhaps we'll meet, I hope, in the near future, not 10 years back. But every human being also has a presence, an existential presence, a unique presence. And we are to meet that person in that particular moment, but as in his or her presence. Now there's another term, the Shekhinah, God's manifestation in our life is referred to as the presence. So in meeting the presence of another beyond the it categories, we necessarily go to a doctor. You need the doctor, please. I'm suffering, by the way, moments. Forgive me for telling you severe constipation. Nonetheless, I'm moving on. But if I go to a doctor, my wife just went to the pharmacy. It's necessary. It's part of the world. I'll come back to the it world in a moment. But it's more than that, of course, than the it world. And our fellow, my physician is also a fellow human being. The pharmacist is also a fellow human being, or in religious terms, an angelic emissary of the divine, of the Shekhinah. And so it's a question of the presence of the individual peering away, parting away, removing the camouflage, if you wish, of it categories. Nonetheless, the world of it is crucial if we understand it as part of God's creation. God did create the trees. He created death, which is the ultimate signature of life. And yet, as it says in Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, love is strong as death. And that is coming back to the notion of chemla, loving compassion. And compassion means somehow being attentive to the other human being in the fullest sense, in the sense of his or her presence. Buber also extends the I-Thou relationship to the world of nature, the trees, the birds, etc. Here, of course, Hasidic material helps them very much. You can worship God in the forest and listen to the chirping of the birds. In other words, our relationship with God is not confined to the synagogue, which, of course, is still crucial, but is only a way of edifying our spiritual sensibilities. And thus, if we truly engage in prayer, liturgically or otherwise, it is to edify, to build up our own spiritual sensibilities, to embrace God's world, the world of creation. And that's crucial. It's often misunderstood by commentators of Buber, who wish to understand him as a pure humanist, but you rightly put him in the category of spiritual humanism. And Buber's understanding of the I-Thou, or sometimes he called it the dialogical relationship, is to indeed not just celebrate, but to sanctify, to hallow the created order, which includes, of course, the trees, the birds, the bread we eat, and obviously our fellow human beings.
Yeah. I'm curious, you mentioned before, just very kind of briefly in passing, you said how we're all angelic, and then you said kind of almost parenthetically, not necessarily in behavior.
Right.
And so I'm curious about that. How do we, because we often experience what seems to us as very sub-angelic behavior right. from others. And that, I think, makes it a lot harder or more difficult for us to engage and see that person in the way that you're talking about now. And I'm curious how we can navigate that in that way to still hold on to this kind of approach in those situations.
Yeah. Buber speaks of the holy risk of reaching out to the other. The other is all of us in various ways have what Buber calls a panzer, a way of protecting ourselves. There's a beautiful, I guess, psychological or psychological midrash on Buber by a non-Jew, a great psychiatrist and existentialist, Carl Jaspers. And he says that each of us are like snails. We hide behind the protective garment of a snail, the shell, and very reluctantly move out of the shell. As soon as there's a shadow of a threat, you move back in. And then we create those shells in many, many ways. And it makes it difficult to counter one another because we are in shells. And just to be a little pun on it, you know, Buber wants us to ensoul the resonance of those shells by trying to nurture mutual trust. And here Buber has a very interesting theological reflection. The Hebrew word for belief is not confessional. You know, we have debates with what are we supposed to believe? Some say it's 3 articles, some say it's 10 articles, etc. But Buber understands faith, emunah, as trust. And interesting, in various translations of the Hebrew Bible by learned Jews who are rooted in the tradition, they translate almost consistently emunah as trust. God is the ground of trust. God created the world, and behold, it is good, indeed very good. And our relationships to one another obviously appeal to trust. The Buber calls, in a perhaps also philosophical way, or the eternal vow, God is always there, unconditional, the source of trust. But in our relationships, we often are met with mistrust, and strategies of mistrust. And the strategy is the way we categorize one another as non-Jews or Jews or Haredi, not Haredi. And that really, those categories demote the angelic presence of the other. And it requires trust, holy risk. And often we reach out to the other and we're rejected. And Buber calls that a mismeeting, but we cannot relinquish the possibility of emunah, of trust, both in the divine sense and, if you wish, in the interpersonal sense. So Buber are not mutually exclusive. In fact, they are homologous. They're identical.
So the if I'm understanding it correctly, the categorizations that we make are ways of, in a sense, trying to find safety for ourselves, which kind of puts up the shell. And what Buber is encouraging us to do is to take what you called a holy risk, which I love that term, the holy risk of peeking out from underneath that shell by removing the categories. And the risk there is that now I'm taking a much more curious, undefined stance towards the presence, as you mentioned before, the presence of the other that's there. And because I'm entering into this space without the categories, that means I'm showing up in that context without knowing what I'm going to meet. And that's the holy risk involved, and allowing that to present itself on its own terms.
Right. That means we have to have the courage to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. All authentic relationships do entail a vulnerability. When you have a truly loving relationship with a partner, then your vulnerabilities are exposed. I see it in terms of the story of Bereshit, of the Gan Eden, in the Garden of Eden. We didn't have any protective clothing. The fact that we are nude, I read as a metaphor for our vulnerability. But of course, we were not vulnerable because, of course, it was paradise where we have mutual trust and we were in the divine presence. But once we left, how you wish to put it, the Garden of Eden, we do wear clothing, not just in the sartorial sense, but in the cultural and political sense as well.
Do you have any thoughts on at least it feels to me that we're not necessarily very good at this, myself very much included. Do you have any thoughts on what contributes to that? Why do we struggle to so much, at least it seems, to live with the type of mindset and stance and way of living that you're expressing now, which sounds so enchanting and amazing when listening to it. But then I know when this conversation sadly ends and I go back to my life, I will struggle to stay in this mindset.
Just by chance, I've had a correspondence with a Chinese student, a woman from Shanghai, who's come to Israel to study Judaism with the hope of teaching Judaism in Shanghai. But I directed her to read. She asked these questions. She mentioned how brutal centralized life and totalitarian life in China is, as opposed to what she experienced here as in Israel. So I suggested that she should read Emil Durkheim, who was the son of a rabbi. And he pointed the fact that with modernity, it was a breakdown of community. It is the individualization. And the individualization has many, many codes, personal advancement, you have to get an education. And certainly in America, you move to where a promising employment may be. And the collapse of community is a feature of the modern world, understood as individualization or individualism, which can lead us to very egocentric, self-centered quest for self-promotion. I taught for many years at an American university, also in Israel, and I've taught in Europe, taught in South America. We have within the academy a system of grading one another, brilliant, promising, and that really ultimately, even amongst conversation of colleagues, we come to give it one another grades. That's a way of itting a person, itting, degrading.
Yeah.
Well, but it also is an expression of the individualism. You have to make it. We call it meritocracy. All these are social codes which remove us from the community, which I think signifies Judaism. The Chinese student said it very brilliantly in a letter to me that what she's witnessed here is that she said it actually almost rabbinically. God gave the Torah to a community, a covenantal community. I was really touched, almost tears, over the inside of this from her reading of Judaism and Durkheim by chance, but from the perspective of a woman who is seeking to liberate herself from the suffocating false community, a totalitarian community, a community of monitoring as opposed to a community of mutual love. And here I think Judaism, traditionally understood, can be an important resource. We have the minyan. What's the promise of the minyan? Is to remind us that our life is one of community, not individual salvation, but communal redemption. We don't have to go into theology, but there is a great distinction between individual redemption, removing one from the angst of this world, to hallowing and glorifying the world that God has given us as a gift. And that is our fellow human beings. As covenant, I think, is a crucial, important feature of what you refer to so beautifully as spiritual humanism.
So the importance of community in this context of not, like as you said, itting other people, but vowing them, I guess, but really not doing anything to them, but experiencing their presence. But I imagine, tell me if I'm right about this, that within the community there needs to be a sense of individuality as well, because otherwise we're going to be kind of itting them yet again just to right. to put them into a mold of a community.
Precisely. Yeah, indeed. Of course, what's crucial, and I'm certain part of your own spiritual, is the kavanah, the consciousness in which we perform the mitzvot and engage in Jewish life. And that's where instruction is very important to help maintain the proper kavanah, intentionality, religious consciousness. The community is only a structure, but a structure that can be valorized by chemla, as I would put it. You know, there was a religious philosopher in Jerusalem, a very iconoclastic individual, Yishayahu Leibovich. Mm-hmm. And he says he goes to the morning minyan every day. There are people he despises politically. He has nothing to do with them. But that's all the glory of the minyan. Wow. It's not a select club. It's not a fraternity. But the minyan represents humanity.
Mm-hmm. And yet there also are, I guess there is, at least within traditional religious Judaism, there is categorization that plays out within that community, right? Is that a contradiction to this, or is that able to fit together?
If it's left on that level, yes, certainly can be a contradiction. But we do need teachers, and we do need Talmidei Chachamim to instruct us. You know, I just wrote this little paper on the Talmid Chacham. We also translate him on Hebrew as the wise person, but it really literally means a student of a wise person. And we are all students of the wisdom that others bear. Of course, within terms of traditional Jewish learning, there are those who are the purveyors of that knowledge, but they are built upon many, many generations. They're all Talmidei Chachamim.
Yeah.
And I think if we just see them as a wise person without that a lineage, then I think we're somehow obliterating this spiritual promise and majesty of a Talmid Chacham.
Yeah. Does all of this exist within oneself also, meaning these two ways of looking at others and looking at God that we're talking about in terms of categorizations and object versus noticing the presence and being curious, yeah. So within the way I relate to myself also?
Most definitely. Of course, we have to peel away the layers of the protective layers that we've devised in order to somehow survive in a ruthlessly individualistic world. But what Buber would say is that our dialogue, and in German he refers to it as a conversation of two, ultimately three because of the divine presence, helps us understand ourselves. It's mutuality. And we do need other people, other partners in our journey to help us come to terms with ourselves. We often can hit one another. That's without going too far in that direction. Buber wrote on psychoanalysis what it was generally called neurosis, is an individual who's overly shelled himself and lost touch with it. He's lost confidence, lost trust in himself. And that's the gift that we give to one another, is that we can trust one another. I remember once, many years ago, I gave a shavuot, I guess you say shavuos, a shiur, and I had difficulty articulating it. And someone in the community said, "Well, it's like a mother giving, or a parent giving the child his or her hand when that child takes his first steps, you know, at the age of 8 months, 10 months, a year. Those are really obviously terrifying, but the child over the, you know, the parent who is healthy is granted that child a trust that the hand that you reach out to the child will not allow him or her to fall." And using that as an analogy to relationships, is that we are all fearful of falling in many ways, but
yeah.
But
I don't know if this is kind of I guess somewhat cliche because it's so talked about, but to me, when I'm listening to you speak about all this, the thing that keeps coming back into my mind is we can't do any of what you're saying when we're moving as fast as we all are all the time. And we need to slow down in order to be able to do that.
Right. Well, at least to be aware.
Yeah. So,
that in rushing through, we may bump into other people and hurt them. You know, I just, if I can just, without promoting myself, please forgive me if it sounds that way. We're now celebrating the 100th anniversary of the publication of Ein Vau in German. And there are two translations in English, which I have been asked to write the introductions to. They just came out in January. But there I refer to something I think is appropriate to what you just said. I'm only mentioning this because there I give more,
yeah,
more
please.
Like explication. But there was a French scholar, actually a writer of detective stories, but a man with great spiritual sensibilities. He spoke about everyday crimes which are not registered in any penal code, but the crimes of when we hurt one another. By well, certain as a teacher, you know, you're prone to accept, give attention to the student who is courageous or outspoken, and you neglect the students who are silent. Or you look at a student with a way frowning, saying, "Well, that's a silly question. You don't say it. I hope you don't say it." But we can't signal. But as a parent, inevitably you're engaged in your own work, and you say, "Please leave me alone," and you don't acknowledge the urgency of the child's appeal. But in so many myriad ways, there are everyday crimes that we hurt one another, rushing through, as you said, bumping into others.
Yeah.
And we just have to be aware of it, of the everyday crimes. Those are really the ones that hurt most. I'll give you an example. I recently had a conversation with a man in his 90s, who I've seen often. And he told me the following story. When he was 16 and his sister was 15, they left on their first overnight hike. The mother approached her daughter, gave her a kiss on the cheek. And then she turned to her son and said, "Would you also like a kiss?" And he held his fist tight and said, "No." And at the age of 90, he remembers that moment when he was 16. "Oh, I wanted that kiss," and began to cry. Little thing, but those that really stamp our inner world. We have to be alert to how these little crimes are ultimately the crimes of our interpersonal life. So very well put, that we're rushing through, we can bump into other people, neglect them as they appeal to us. So it's a question of slowing down, just to be, well, slowing down in the sense of being alert to how we inevitably hurt one another, but how we can modify the hurt.
Yeah. You mentioned before that the world of the I-it, is also created by God and so has to have, in some sense, a sanctity as well. I'm curious if you could elaborate on how do we look at the I-it, I guess, from more than just the pragmatic need, but also is there a way of looking at that in a more sanctified way?
Yes, Buber coined the term pansacramentalism. It borrows it from Christian theological discourse, something that evokes God's presence. For the Christian, it's largely through the sacraments, the blood and the bread, made God's presence as a sacrament. But Buber speaks of all of life as having the possibility of being sacramentalized, that is to say, to evoke God's presence. And I vow baffles many people. He talks about a relationship to trees. How could but he says very interestingly, we can see a tree as a pine tree or some botanical vocabulary, casting the trees as a species. But if you stop, each tree has its own presence. And even in the brachot for that as well.
Right.
The transsacramentalism is, I think, you don't need the term, but to realize that we can hallow the everyday, all aspects of life. And that is to say, God is, as you put it so well in your book, and I'm not just praising you, I'm really urging you, your Hasidim, to read the book.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
But all aspects of life can evoke the presence of the divine. And that's crucial to say, that as we put it before, the angel, all aspects of life are angels.
Yeah. So to me, tell me if I'm hearing this correctly, to me that sounds like the idea is that even in the I-it moments, we can resurface the I-thou. But I guess what I was wondering from what you said before is there a way in which the I-it itself, there's an angle through which to look at that as itself being holy in some way?
Yes. Well, I think it's almost the same thing as you said. Yeah. It's holy because it's part of the created order. You know, mm-hmm. Buber had in trying to articulate his concept of I and thou, had a very intense conversation with his friend, Franz Rosenzweig. And Rosenzweig said that there's a danger of giving ultimate salience to the I thou moment. And he alerted the Buber, God created the world and the it. I just wrote a paper on trying to elaborate this. Is what I would call the sanctifying the world of it, or redemption of the world of it, to redeem the world of it, because it's redeemable. Right.
It brings to mind the teaching of the Alter Rebbe of Lubavitch in Shar Yichud VeEmunah, where he talks about that because it seems to me that in some sense maybe you could map like an overlay of it being almost the exterior or the klipa, if we will, the shell, and the I thou as being the interior and the or, and so the almost the chiddush or the novelty of the Alter Rebbe in that work is that the shell itself is also a divine revelation, and actually in some ways is rooted in some even loftier source. Right. I mean, we're getting a little bit more esoteric now, but
yeah, I just mentioned that as I think you mentioned briefly, the Hasidic concept of the divine sparks and everything, and also in the klipot, the covering. But I wanted to say something much more in principle. Without being polemical, but there was a great divide between Judaism and in the centuries of its formation as a faith that we know, with something called a trend in thought known as Gnosticism. Let me just say briefly what that is involved. Gnosticism comes to the word gnosis. We know it, agnostic, not knowing. It's a Greek term for knowledge. And the knowledge that was offered by the schools of thought that come under the rubric of Gnosticism claimed that the world we live in is awful. We don't belong here. Our souls should be elsewhere, because the world is too compromised with temptation, the pain, the rot of aging, if you want to put it that way, and death. So our the Gnostics said the soul is incarcerated, is captured in the body, in this world of creation. And I even went so far as to say the Jews gave us a wrong idea. It became very anti-Jewish that the world is created. That's a lie. It's a lie. And the Gnostics offered knowledge to somehow to break out of the prison of life, to reach out to the upper world. I think you allude to that when you say that there are those who seek spirituality by removing ourselves from the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's Gnosticism. And many Jewish thinkers that you are familiar with in the 20s, a variety of reasons why in the 20s, but one to note that felt it was a neo-Gnostic push in European thought. And that was Buber, Rosenzweig, Heschel, and others who said, no, we just can't relinquish from the concept of God, of the created order. That is a blessing that we, of course, have to bless. It's not just this, that he's saying hi. It's that we have to bless it or sanctify it or hallow it. But he became a very significant struggle. One way of understanding Hitler and the Shoah is that it was a Gnostic notion that you have to save the world, especially from those who save life, I should say, from those who gave us this false delusionary concept of creation, namely the Jews. And I think one very instructive way of understanding the horror that visited our people and humanity at large was this Gnostic view. So without giving you a greater, and not embarrassing, I think you deserve it. Spiritual humanism is an answer, a very important answer to not only the dilemmas of modern life, but Gnostic views that this world is not worth our energy. And the only way to survive is being ruthless.
Thank you so much for sharing all of this wisdom and this time. If I can end with one last question and to try and maybe bring a lot of this conversation to maybe something a little bit more practical in a tangible sense. I'm curious if somebody listens to what you shared and undoubtedly is moved to want to try and engage others and themselves and God and all things from seeking the presence as opposed to the automatic categorizations, and they want to peer out from under the shell that they often find themselves in. What would be, if you're able to, kind of a first step in the process of trying to move towards that direction?
We call it in Hebrew, cheshbon nefesh, is an accounting of where we find our souls, and often in places that are not really conducive, ennobling to a life of Jewish spirituality, or as you will put it, spiritual spirituality, or spiritual humanism. The spirit and the human are ultimately, should be one, although often we have sundered the relationship, broken the relationship, and that requires cheshbon nefesh. As you perhaps know, this is more about the Litvaks than the Hasidim, but the Nusa movement has a very strong sense of that we should constantly be, especially if there are rituals going out, midnight meditation, hitbot adut, as they call it, as a cheshbon nefesh. It's a daily requirement. Yeah.
Thank you. Hey, thank you so much for this time and this conversation. Really appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please follow us on WhatsApp, YouTube, or Instagram. All our podcast series can be found wherever you listen to podcasts. I'd love to hear from you, so please reach out with questions, comments, or suggestions, or to be added to our WhatsApp groups. You can reach us through email using yakov.attached@gmail.com or on WhatsApp at 773-888-2413.